a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
All right, Committee on State Affairs, and I'll come to order. Check your cell phones. And Secretary, would you please call the roll?
Senators Brown.
Here.
Frerichs.
Here.
Holeen. Lederman.
Here.
Lucas. Excuse. Maher. Thiessen.
Here.
Rave.
Here.
Roney.
We have a quorum. The minutes were provided. Any comments or action? Approval by Brown.
Second.
Second by Frerichs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. I'd like to welcome all of you to State Affairs today and all those folks listening on the internet. We have our page. Would you come up and introduce yourself? Tell us where you're from and what your plans are after school, please.
I'm Jenny Palmer. I'm from here in Pierre, and I plan on going to the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul and majoring in either entrepreneurship or biology.
Excellent. Good. Well, thanks for helping out these last week, and you got 1 week left. All right. With that, we'll open committee hearing on House Bill 1212. House Bill 1212 is now open for public hearing and testimony. Are there any proponents for House Bill 1212?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Steve Westra, District 13.
I don't think you're on, Steve, are you? Or?
I am, yeah.
Okay, there you go. A little closer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Representative Steve Westra, Minnehaha, Lincoln County, which is Sioux Falls. I come before you today with House Bill 1212, which is an act to provide for open and fair competition in government contracts. This bill would ban what are known as project labor agreements, or short PLA mandates, on publicly funded construction in the state of South Dakota. The purpose of this bill is to ensure economy and efficiency on taxpayer-funded construction in our state. Let me just give you a little bit of background, or some of you might want some clarity as to what a project labor agreement is. And essentially, it is a pre-hire agreement between a contractor, sometimes a project owner, and organized labor that lays out the terms and conditions of employment on a construction project. In the modern construction marketplace, 98% of the workforce here in the state of South Dakota chooses not to join a union. PLA mandates are a way to eliminate competition from non-union or merit shop contractors on taxpayer-funded construction projects. Requirements on PLAs can vary, but almost all of them include provisions that are so objectionable to most merit shop contractors that they simply will not bid on projects when signing a PLA is a condition of performing work. For example, nearly all PLA require contractors to recognize a union as a representative of their workers, hire all or a majority of their workers for the PLA project from unions, likely displacing their existing workforce for that project, and they are required to follow inefficient and outdated union work rules. Now, most PLAs also require contractors to pay union wages and into union pension and benefit programs. And in many instances here in the state of South Dakota, these contractors are already paying higher wages than that. This not only forces the contractors into paying double benefits for any non-union worker on a PLA project, once into existing funds and then again into union funds as required under the PLA, but non-union workers on the project are unlikely to be able to collect these benefits unless they join the union. PLA mandates in South Dakota would have dire consequences for the local construction industry. As a result of the onerous requirements included in PLAs, any PLA mandate in South Dakota would make it nearly impossible for local contractors to compete for projects funded by their very own tax dollars. Again, because more than 98% of the state's construction workforce is non-union, contractors on PLA projects would be forced to displace South Dakota workers and instead use union workers from outside our state. These mandates are also bad for taxpayers because PLAs have been found to increase construction costs. And in addition, they reduce competition from merit shop contractors. As a result, union contractors know that there's going to be less competition, and they know they won't need to sharpen their pencils on bid day. And consequently, conservative estimates are that PLAs can increase construction costs by as much as 20%, although there are plenty of examples where PLA cost premium is closer to 25 or 30%. So as other states have become familiar with this issue, a number of them have taken action designed to keep these wasteful and discriminatory mandates out of the state. And since January 2010, 10 states have banned government-mandated PLAs, including North Dakota, bringing the total number to 18. I believe here in South Dakota, we've been good fiscal stewards of our state, and it would not make sense for our state agencies or local governments to restrict our bidders and inflate cost. This bill is designed to ensure that taxpayers always have open bidding. I believe this is an important issue for South Dakota, and I would ask for favorable passage of House Bill 1212. I will stand by for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further proponents, House Bill 1212. Further proponents.
Mr. Chairman. Eric Matt, I'm a lobbyist, a registered lobbyist, and an attorney in Sioux Falls representing the Associated Builders and Contractors. The Associated Builders and Contractors is an organization that consists primarily of merit shop workers. Our contractors follow the non-union model. They hire non-union workers and do construction projects in that fashion. We would stand and strongly support House Bill 1212 today to promote fair competition and also to promote the stewardship of taxpayer dollars. We've found from our experience, our contractors have found that PLAs make it much harder to bid on projects and also increase costs for taxpayers. There have been reports of costs increasing as much as 20% on some of these projects in other states, and we've noticed that it is a threat in other states. Some of our neighboring states, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, have seen some issues with this, with these PLAs, and we don't want to wait until it comes here to address the issue. In addition, what we found PLAs do, many have indicated that South Dakota is a right-to-work state, and it is, and that's a very important thing, and so are these other states like Iowa and Nebraska. What we've seen is that right-to-work is not really enough because, as Representative Wester pointed out, these PLAs can enforce other requirements rather than just paying union dues. Right now in South Dakota, the right-to-work state makes it so you can't, as a condition of employment, you can't require an employee to pay union dues, but what you can do is require through these project labor agreements require the payment of union pension plans and also the following of union work rules, which would make it very difficult for our contractors to be competitive and bid on these jobs. I'd also like to emphasize very quickly what this bill doesn't do. It doesn't restrict anybody from bidding on a government project, whether the contract uses a union model or a non-union model. That contractor could still bid. They could still receive the contract. It just ensures that everybody has a level playing field when these bids are let. So I'd encourage everybody on the committee today to be proactive. 18 states in the nation have enacted similar laws to ensure fair competition and protect taxpayer dollars, including our neighboring state of North Dakota. And I'd encourage this committee to take the same action and support House Bill 1212. I'll stand by for any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. On the phone, we have Gary Johnson from AGE Corporation. Gary, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can. We'll continue with proponent testimony. Go ahead, Gary.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Gary Johnson, President, AGE Corporation Contractors in Fort Pierre. Forgive me for not being there, though I'm at Associated General Contractors of America National Meeting today. Many of you have traveled to Pierre on highways and projects that we have built. We've been in business, it'll be 50 years in June, as AGE Corporation. My granddad started the company in 1952. By himself. We are now a fourth-generation business construction company with my two sons that are working with us now. They graduated from South Dakota State in 2010. As a member of the National Board of Governors of the AGC of America, AGC does not support project labor agreements, and that's on a national level. Our group, our AGC of America group, is comprised of both open shop and closed shop union, non-union contractors. And as a whole, we believe that the playing field for everybody needs to be the same. The motto of the Associated General Contractors is skill, responsibility, and integrity. When I testified before the House body on this bill, I was asked about benefits in our industry, mine specifically, and was asked if we had retirement plan. Yes, we do. We provide a 401k that employees are allowed to participate in, health insurance benefits, and those kind of things, paid vacation that are often taunted by the other group. So with that, we would hope that you would support this, and I'll be available for any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I think we'll deviate from normal protocol here. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Johnson before we let him go? Any questions? It's pretty quiet, Mr. Johnson, so thank you for your testimony, and appreciate you taking time.
Thank you.
All right. Further proponents? Any further proponents? House Bill 1212. Just so the group is aware, we also have one more phone-in proponent. We'll dial up here and have them standing by. Go ahead, Deb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Start over. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Deb Mortensen. I'm the registered lobbyist for the Associated General Contractors, both the Highway Heavy Utility Chapter and the Building Chapter, and we are here today in support of House Bill 1212. You heard from our member and past president, Gary Johnson, just now talking about the competitive bid process. AGC in South Dakota represents more than 300 contractors who use a competitive bid process. We bid on in excess of $300 million worth of state-funded, taxpayer-funded, I should say, public improvement projects each year. Those public improvement projects go to build things from bridges to water treatment, wastewater infrastructure, elementary schools, county buildings, facilities in parks, roads in parks, prisons, university buildings, all sorts of stuff like that. On bid letting day, low bid wins. Right now, the competitive bid process in South Dakota means that your playing field is level. It depends on how sharp your pencil is and how good your estimates are. And the AGC feels that the introduction of project labor agreements will scuttle all that. It'll muddy the waters. As you've heard from testimony before, we feel that it's going to drive up project costs and reduce competition. Not a good use of your taxpayer dollars. We would encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to our phone proponent. We'll continue proponent testimony. Mr. Sabers?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead, Terry.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for allowing me to testify this morning by phone. I am Terry Sabers. I'm vice president here at Muth Electric. We're based in Mitchell, and we have six other locations in South Dakota. And we also have an office in Omaha and Williston, North Dakota, and we work regularly in seven or eight states surrounding us. We've been in business for 43 years, have built our business in the competitive bidding market, so we're very familiar with it. We do small projects and many large projects, including the electrical right now on the event center in Sioux Falls, as well as Shields and a couple others. And we have over 330 employees spread throughout these offices. You know, I mentioned that we build our business in the competitive bidding market, and this legislation does ensure that competition will be present on all governmental projects, even on the larger projects like the event center. We've seen some projects in other states that are affected by mandatory labor agreements and what it can do to eliminate competition and take firms such as ours out of the running for those projects. Also, this is a very important legislation to preserve the rights of both the workers in South Dakota as well as the employers of South Dakota. As you know, the right to work laws in South Dakota do allow workers to obtain work without being forced or required to join a union. We've built our company over the last 43 years as a merit shop contractor that follows that premise. We have not found a need to sign a collective bargaining agreement. Our employees are happy with the arrangement they have and are compensated well for their merits, which is well above the average for South Dakota. Last year, in fact, we just looked at it, we had quite a number of our electricians earn more than $90,000 working in the field, plus a full list of benefits. So, then if a labor agreement of some kind is required by a governmental entity on a project, our employees' rights by right to work will go away. And under the long-standing process in South Dakota, employees such as ours would be shut out of that project and not have the opportunity to be involved without a major change in our labor arrangement. So for them to be involved, we'd be required to sign a labor agreement, which we could not do, or it would totally disrupt our business. We would be forced to walk away from the project, and our employees would not have the opportunity to be involved in the project. And that's just not right in South Dakota. This legislation will ensure that situation cannot happen to our employees or our company. This legislation would also ensure that it would not happen to over 90% of the other construction companies in South Dakota that have similar merit shop arrangements as ours. A required labor agreement would have a far-reaching effect on companies that would want to be involved and but would not have that opportunity. It is important to pass this legislation to ensure that competition remains fair here in South Dakota. Thanks again for the chance to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Sabers. If you stand by just for 1 second, are there any questions of the committee for Mr. Sabers? Any questions? Nope, seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Sabers. Have a good day.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Further proponent testimony, House Bill 1212. Any further proponents? Last call. Any proponents? Seeing none, we'll close proponent testimony and open to opponent testimony. Any opponents to House Bill 1212?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Anderson, registered lobbyist for the South Dakota State Federation of Labor. I think I'm here today to maybe clear up some misconceptions about project labor agreements. I think we're looking at something in South Dakota that's never happened. There's never been one, and there's a reason for that, because the majority of projects in South Dakota simply aren't big enough. But I think we're looking at putting some legislation on the books that really isn't necessary. I think there's been a lot of fear generated over what's happened maybe in some other states or I'm not sure what. Iowa in particular, there's been a lot of, there have been some project labor agreements there. In fact, the Iowa Supreme Court voted 6-1 to uphold the right of public entities to have project labor agreements. And they talked a little bit about North Dakota. North Dakota actually did pass a bill to limit project labor agreements, but Nebraska did not. And I guess I have with me, and I'm going to try and maybe not take up too much time, but in the case in Nebraska, when this was brought up down there, there's 32 pages of testimony supporting project labor agreements that were put on the record in Nebraska when this bill was there, and it did not pass. A little bit of understanding where this bill comes from, and I'm just going to lay this pile of studies. I didn't see another person bring a study here that said that project labor agreements were bad. This pile of studies here says that they're helpful to not only workers, but also taxpayers. And also in the people that are supporting this legislation, I did not see one public entity here testifying for it. I would assume that it hasn't been a problem anywhere, and I don't think that they think it will be a problem, because really what project labor agreements are is they are a way for public entities to hold down the costs of projects that they think a project labor agreement would work on. So I think maybe we'll start out with where this legislation came from. I've got a handout here. And it's pretty clear that it's, I think, at least in my mind, that it's essentially corporate-sponsored legislation. This little handout has shows the corporate sponsors of ALEC. And on the back, it has the bill that's in front of you today, and it shows where those pieces of legislation from 1995 have slowly moved into this piece that we're talking about today. I think we'll At least I'll maybe go back and talk a little bit about PLAs. Clearly, PLAs are bid specifications. They standardize labor conditions. They set the basic terms and conditions of employment for an entire construction project. I think I got another handout here. And that particular study is in this pile. I mean, I think this handout is interesting because this deals with, I think it's $2.1 billion measure in San Diego, and it deals with a school district. And one of the board members on that school district was a person who felt that project labor agreements were a bad idea. So what they did in San Diego, they commissioned a study to find that out. And the statement from that particular person that got that commission, or that study commissioned, his statement is pretty simple. His name is Mr. Barnett. It says, the facts are clear. The PSA is good for taxpayers in San Diego. There has not been any increase in construction costs from before the PSA or after the PSA. So, and then on the back of that letter that was sent out concerning that study, there are some things on the back. They talk about that project labor agreements are good for taxpayers and local jobs. And that's one misconception about project labor agreements. First off, we've talked about they're legal. PLAs are the only legal mechanism for ensuring a local workforce and promoting the hiring of local veterans on a project through the Helmets and Hard Hats program. Local hiring keeps local tax dollars in the community. One other thing it does is if you happen to be in a community where there's a lot of disadvantaged population, you can use that project labor agreement to make sure those individuals get hired. And there was some discussion about the proponents on this bill that non-union contractors are forced to sign an agreement. That's absolutely not true. They don't have to sign any union contract. They don't have to. The people that are hired do not have to join the union. There's nothing in a project labor agreement that makes that happen. So I think it's important that we take a really hard look at what's going on here. I've got another handout here that shows how the hiring works. Another thing to keep in mind on these project labor agreements is the quality of workers. Quality construction depends on skilled workers. Union programs provide most of the training in the trades. And one of these reports spells that out. Even among open shop contractors, moreover, their top people tend to be union trained. PLAs establish work schedules and labor continuity for projects completion. PLAs provide a trained, skilled, and productive labor force, and PLAs incorporate common dispute resolution mechanisms across all trades. I happen to work in the construction trades, and sometimes on a project, I've never happened to work on one that had a PLA on it, but sometimes on projects there are issues between the different crafts, and when you have, like a PLA sets up a committee to take care of that, and those issues are resolved rather quickly. So I just think there's a lot of issues with what's been said earlier. I think you really need to take a hard look at who's pushing this. I think you need to take a hard look at the advantage that this gives to a local government, whether it's a state, a city, a county, or whatever, that they have the option to use this. Like I said before, it's never been used in the state. Because of the size of projects, I don't expect that it probably ever will be. But I don't think you should take that opportunity away from local governments to be able to use a PLA if they get a chance. I got another handout here that deals with what happened in Iowa. And this talks about that study that was done in Iowa and the conclusions that were reached. And there's six conclusions in there. I'm just going to read a couple of them to you that are in that. You can take a look at the people that did that study. So if you go to the fourth conclusion, it says, PLAs on private sector construction projects is clear evidence that PLAs are useful as an engineering management tool and produce significant net benefits. There's another study in here, a California study, where 59 of the 82 projects studied were private construction projects. Bechtold, a major nationwide construction contractor, was also surveyed for the Iowa study. It reported that it had done 100 PLA projects over the last 25 years, with 85% in the private sector. Since the owners of private projects are out to make money, the widespread use of PLAs on these projects over long time spans is a good indication that PLAs, as an arrangement for organizing the project, especially on large and or complex projects, most often produce positive net benefits. Six, the purpose of a PLA on a complex public sector construction project is to provide a mechanism for organizing all the different people on the worksite into an efficient and coordinated workforce. The public gets more value for its dollar when all the work is coordinated. PLAs are good for these things. Now, I did hear some testimony earlier from one of the people on the phone, and so I want to hand out this other handout that talks about a wage study survey that was done in South Dakota for the heavy and highway contractors. And it deals with essentially wages that are paid on the Davis-Bacon project. And I would like you to note that this particular wage survey took into account what the AGC pays for wages. And if you take a look at that, one of the comments that was made earlier was the fact that they pay fringe benefits. But when they submitted their information in this study, no account was made for the fringe benefits. So you can see on a highway project that the AGC does, what the state looks at when they're looking at wages, or what the federal government looks at when they're looking at wages. And benefits are clearly not a part of that. And so I know I've put out quite a bit of information here, and it's probably in the short time that we have, it's pretty tough to take a look at all that stuff. And I would note, though, that we did have some testimony from Muth Electric, and they do not only do jobs in South Dakota. They're in other states in the area. the same principle that non-union contractors will bid on projects where standard labor conditions exist has also been held true on projects performed under Davis-Bacon Act. And so in Omaha, the federal courthouse building, those wages were set similar to the way a project labor agreement would do. And Muth Electric did bid on that contract in Omaha, and they did get the job. So I don't think that it's necessarily true. When you get into a job that has a project labor agreement, I don't believe it's necessarily true that that keeps non-union contractors off the job. If they're not bidding on that job, it's because they don't want to. They have a clear choice to do that. Project labor agreements do not in any way limit who bids on the job. It's open to everyone. Now, I just want to bring up, to kind of back that up, in California, anti-PLA groups filed suit regarding the use of a PLA on a reservoir project undertaken by the Metropolitan Water District of California. The court hearing the case found that 78 non-union contractors had bid on and been awarded work as prime contractors or subcontractors, constituting 75% of all the contractors working on that project. In Nevada, the Southern Nevada Water Authority conducted an improvement project in two phases, one without PLAs and the second with. The number of non-union contractors bidding and being awarded contracts on the project actually increased when the PLA was used on phase two. Three of the 15 contractors went to non-union contractors on the non-PLA portion, and six of the 16 contractors went to non-union contractors on the phase under which the PLA was used. So I think there's a whole lot of hysteria from a limited number of people in South Dakota about PLAs. I really don't think they're an issue, for one thing, because they've never been here, and because of the size of projects we do, they probably never will be. But if they do come to South Dakota, on the slim chance that they do, then there's nothing in the record of the things that I brought you today that show that they're a problem. They don't keep non-union contractors off the job. They don't keep non-union workers off the job. It's very important that you understand that PLAs do two things. They're a tool that can be used by the local government entity to keep the cost of the project down. There would be no reason to use one if it was going to drive the cost up. No reason. And the other thing it does is it keeps the work local. Even if the project labor agreement, the person that bids on that particular project is a union contractor, when a union contractor comes into an area where there's a project labor agreement, they use the local hiring hall. And the first people that are hired come out of that community. They do not come out of state. Most project labor agreements are set up so that the contractor can bring in some of their top people to make sure that the project goes well. The people that know how to run it will be there. But the rest of the people, whether they're union or non-union, go through the hiring hall and come onto that project. So I think you all understand that my job is to represent the unions. That's what I do. But I also represent workers. And when you take a look at the advantages of a project labor agreement, I don't think there's any reason to limit it. Now, like I said, there's no reason to use it if it's not to the advantage of the community and the taxpayers. And I think our local entities in South Dakota, whether it's county, state, or municipality, are smart enough to figure that out. So really, the only thing that this bill does is it takes away the ability of that local entity to decide how they want to run that local project. That's all it does. So with that, I'll stand down and wait for any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Any further opponents to House Bill 1212? Any further opponents? Last call. Any further opponents? Seeing none. Representative Westra, would you like a brief rebuttal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'll be brief. I just want to touch on a few things that were just talked about. I want to be clear to everybody. This is not an Alec bill. This is a Steve Westra bill, and it's also a bill of thousands and thousands of hardworking people here in the state of South Dakota that want to make sure that they have fairness when it comes to these contracts going forward. Let's talk about what House Bill 1212 really is, and it really is a classic free market bill. It's a fairness bill, and it ensures that South Dakota taxpayers get the best construction for the best price and that there's fair competition. But more importantly, it ensures that all companies can enter into these contracts. And I think when you do that, you save taxpayers money. And to respond to another comment that was made, there are numerous cases out there of showing where project labor agreements at a bare minimum can cost 20% in additional money. I don't think that's the best use of taxpayer dollars, but more importantly, I think I'll just leave you with the fact that when you look at that 98% of the workforce in the state of South Dakota is non-union, let's make sure that we allow them the opportunity to continue to be to bid on these projects going forward. So with that, I would ask a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. All right, with that, we'll close testimony and open to committee questions. Any questions of the committee? All right. Seeing none, we'll close committee questions. Move to committee comments, discussion, and or action. Senator Lederman.
Mr. Chair, I move to pass.
Motion to pass by Lederman, second by Brown. Comments on that motion, Senator Lederman?
I think that the proponents laid out a compelling argument, and I think that we could safely move ahead with this bill.
Any further comments? Senator Friggs?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to vote no on the bill today, but I guess what I draw for a comparison would be I look to our neighbors to the north, and I realize it's not a complete, accurate comparison, but it's something that I think is related to this subject. We saw where one of the beet companies up there, sugar beet companies, had a lockout which lasted, I believe, almost a year or even longer. And in that situation, when they had to get spec workers in to fulfill those shifts and obviously complete their operations, it was certainly a proven fact that it costed them a lot more by having to go out and find whoever they could bring in from whichever state at high costs. And so I think from that comparison where, again, they were locked out, yes, it was because of an agreement, but the point was that both sides weren't going to give anything. And in the end, when they had to go out and find all these other workers to fulfill the shifts, it cost them more. So with that, I understand the intent of the legislation. At first blush, it sounds pretty straightforward. But when we look at the complex issue here, I'm going to vote no today hope that the committee realizes that it's obviously searching for a problem as opposed to trying to solve a potential problem that's in front of us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any further comments and or action? Right. Seeing none, we have a motion to pass before us. All those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. And the Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Brown.
Aye.
Frerichs.
No.
Pauline.
Aye.
Lederman.
Aye.
Lucas. It's excused. Maher.
Aye.
Teason.
Aye.
Rave.
Aye.
Roden.
Aye.
Motion passes. We'll go to the floor with a do pass motion. All right. With that, we will open testimony on HJR 1002. Representative Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, members of State Affairs, my name is Charlie Hoffman. I'm a representative in District 23, and I'm representing myself and all the people who have come before us and actually been limited to only four terms in their service because of term limits. Historically, there's been a number of times that this has been brought before the public. They've voted down every one of them. But this extension, as written, has never been brought before the people. To abolish term limits has been brought before the people. To change term limits to 4, 4, and 2, coinciding with the census that redistricts has been brought, and every one of those have been killed. This is an extension. Simple. All it does is moves our current language of four terms and your term limited to six terms. Now, just the meat and potatoes of this, if you were running again in the next election and you had only three terms behind you and you're running for your last term, should this pass, you actually will get three terms left. You'll get 6 years. This is a 12-year term. Four plus two is 6 times 2 is 12. Now, if you're term limited at the election, your term ends, whether this bill passes or not. That's in statute. The reason for this is the reason that I think, and the reason why I think this is going to pass, no one has ever taken ownership as a legislator on extending term limits. I'm not running again. I despise term limits. And there's a number of reasons. They're all good for me, and it's the right time to do this. But I'm going to be going to the public with the help of Senator Lederman, and I'm going to be selling this. I'm going to have Cracker Barrels, I'm going to have meetings, and we're going to put a media blitz together, and I've already had people in the industry say they will help me. The reason this is important, and I think this is something that will give you credence to vote for this, and I'll use my own analogy. When you come into the House or Senate and you're a freshman, it's a straight-up learning jump. You don't have a curve. You have to get it right off the bat. You have to learn how to do process. You have to learn how to be a good committee member. You have to learn the rules in either house that you're on. You cannot waste any time in making a decision. It has to be immediately if you're going to be running for leadership. There's one window today to become a speaker or a majority leader in either house. You don't have an option of waiting. If this passes, you can come in, you can take one term, and you can get to know the process. Your next term, you make a decision to be a majority or minority whip leader. Then you can make a decision whether you want to run. And if you don't have that option right then, you have another option of becoming, you have two options to be a majority leader or a speaker. The power in this institution is now, under the current term limits, heavily swayed toward the executive branch and all of the lobbyists. The institutional knowledge, unless you're flipping back and forth on a consistent basis, but there's a difference between the Senate and the House. The old, really institutionalized, knowledgeable folks that we used to have in this business, they aren't here anymore. New faces, 20 to 25 new legislators, between 15 to 30. Every election is a brain drain that I don't believe is good for the state of South Dakota. Term limits happen every 2 years at the polls for the people. If they don't like you, they can get rid of you. But for us, staying in this institution and being a part of the knowledge base, growing, understanding why a bill didn't pass, understanding why certain people may be against your bill, that's all part of a long-term. The things we do in this business that we never once gave credence to thinking about before are immense. And I'm going to help sell this, and I'm hoping that today you give me an opportunity to at least get it to the Senate floor, where I know that Senator Lederman and those of you who may be in favor of this can help get it onto the governor's desk. And after it gets signed by it won't go to the governor's desk. It goes right to the people. Once it gets passed off the Senate floor, I'll take it to the people. And that's my fall job will be to sell this. I'll take ownership of it. That's all I can promise you. So with that, I appreciate your time. I hope I've explained it well. If you have any questions, I'm certainly more than willing to answer them. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hoffman. Further proponents on HJR 1002. Further proponents.
Mr. Chairman, permission to give proponent testimony from committee.
Granted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to second the remarks of Representative Hoffman. I believe that as we look towards extending a citizens' legislature, that we have to look at it as also strengthening that legislature. And one thing that the former speaker did not talk about was he talked about the second floor, he talked about lobbyists, but he didn't talk about a lot of the cabinet secretaries or the department secretaries and the department staff. And in those, you can have folks that are there for 30 or 40 years. And if we as a legislature can't keep some of our membership in for longer periods of time in the chamber where they can grow and become better legislators, it's very easy for those that are entrenched in the bureaucracy of our system to override what the legislature is trying to do year in, year out. I would also like to add that this is new, and this is something different that we haven't taken to the folks, the people before, for a vote. And so I believe that we're giving our voters an option. Now, even though Representative Hoffman opposes term limits, I do support term limits, but I believe that this is a good step for us to extend them and give the legislature a better voice for our citizens.
Thank you, Representative Lederman. Any further proponent testimony? Any further proponents? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Any opponent testimony to HJR 1002? Any opponents? Last call. Seeing none, we'll close, we'll waive rebuttal and open for committee questions. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, we'll close questions, move to committee discussion and or action. Senator Thiessen.
Thank you. Let me just take a minute and offer my comments about term limits. I'm sort of the consummate flip-flopper in this area. When we first voted on term limits in this state, I voted against them because I thought term limits belong at the ballot box and we should vote people in and out based on their merits. And then later I convinced myself that term limits were a good thing. Maybe that was about the time that my senator got term limited in my district. And there was an opening. Maybe that influenced it. And then I came to Peer, and then it became very clear to me that term limits were a bad thing. And I cite three reasons, some of which have been already described here. First of all, leadership is an issue. I agree that there is a steep learning curve with eight-year term limits as it is, and the leadership learning curve is even much steeper. And so I think it has the potential to affect the leadership in our legislature. Secondly, I believe the balance of power argument is a very valid one. The bureaucrats work in the executive branch, and when we have no institutional knowledge or little institutional knowledge in the legislature, I think we suffer from that imbalance of power, and I don't think that serves the citizens of South Dakota very well. And finally, I would say that what we're really doing with term limits is taking power away from the people. It just doesn't seem, when you think about it, it doesn't seem right if a particular district has a legislator that they love and want to continue to send that legislator to the House or to the Senate for 20 years, why should the other voters in different districts have term limits that prevent the voters in that district from doing that? It seems rather sort of an arbitrary thing that the voters in a district should be able to decide if that's who they want representing them or not. And by having term limits, we prevent that process from taking place. So I've been... like I said, I've been both sides of this issue, but I'm now, having been here for a few years, I'm very convinced that term limits are detrimental to the legislature and therefore detrimental to the people. I think this is one step in the right direction, although if I were king for a day, we would do away with the term limits. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Further comments or action?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Maher.
I'll move to pass.
Second.
Motion to pass by Maher, second by Lederman. Comments on that motion, Senator Maher?
I guess I'm a product of term limits, and I'm going to be term limited myself. I just find it interesting. When I came in 8 years ago, there was a big group of us that came into the Senate 8 years ago. I think there was 14 or 15 of us. And at the end of this year, there's going to be two of us who are going to be term limited in the Senate. Just shows you how much turnover there really is, and that the fact that the two that are term limited, you're going to lose some institutional memory and knowledge there. So I'm not saying I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread, but and maybe it's good that I'm gone too. So, but I do agree with it. I do agree with the bill. So.
Thank you. Any further comments on the do pass motion? Any further comments? Right, hearing none, the motion before us is do pass. All those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary, please call the roll.
Senator Brown.
No.
Furyk.
Aye.
Boleyn.
Aye.
Lederman.
Aye.
Lucas, excused. Maher.
Aye.
Keeson.
Aye.
Brave.
Aye.
Roden.
No.
Six ayes, two noes. Motion do pass goes to the HJR. 1002 will go to the floor of the do pass motion. With that, that brings us to the end of today's calendar. Have a meeting on Wednesday. I think the chairman said we have a full calendar on Wednesday as well. Without any other business?
Just to reiterate, we have our calendar. We have one more committee hearing on Wednesday. We also have the ability for a committee hearing on Monday. My intentions are to hold that basically in reserve for cleanup, and we will take all the substantive bills on Wednesday.
Okay. Thank you. With that, motion to adjourn by Brown, second by Maher. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. We are adjourned.